White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for being here for episode 16 of the International Jew Study Hour. Hadding Scott and I, Carolyn Yeager, are your hosts for this hour. Good evening, Hadding.
Hello.
Okay, now, last week we stopped about one-fourth of the way into chapter 13, which is titled Jewish Plan to Split Society by Ideas. So tonight we're going to finish this chapter. And to give a short review of what we did last week, I have accumulated this. I didn't quite finish, but the method by which the protocols work for the breakdown of society is disintegration, or the breakdown is called disintegration. And protocols declare that it's a method that takes time, and that they have indeed taken centuries to get to where we are now. But in America, it has required only 50 years. And the center of Jewish power is now in America. And it tells us that the first attack is on collective opinion. This is from the protocols. This is what the international Jew writers take from, you know, as they're looking at the protocols. This is what they discover. The first attack is on collective opinion. I like that idea. It's pretty clear. What is collective opinion? Well, it's the body of ideas which, through men's agreement with them, holds large groups together in political, racial, religious, or social unity. They're also called standards or ideals.
It's consensus.
And so, pardon me?
Consensus.
Or consensus. Yes, consensus. So this is, of course, what we need to have a viable social order, but this is exactly what's being attacked by enemies, such as, according to the international Jew, the international Jews being our enemy, and this is what they know they have to attack this. Let's see if there's anything else in there that, anyway, they got that part. All right. And they tell us things like, if we find that what they're telling us, if we start to question it, you know, if we say, well, you know, they use general good sounding things like democracy, or what is some of the other here? Things that sound inspiring and you can't really argue with. And yet, when you see it in action, if you say, well, we don't really think this is working out too well, their answer will usually be that we are not yet sufficiently advanced. We are not yet sufficiently advanced to see why this will work better and so on. So they try to get the people to feel like they don't quite understand yet, but if they just wait, they'll see how it all works out. And the ideas are always that it's going to be good, reasonable, inspiring, humane, and then later it's just forced. It's just enforced. But anyway, well, they're not really getting to that part yet. So, you know, democracy is something that is being questioned by the international Jew, which is a good thing that they're doing that. And they also tell us that the truth is frequently depressing. It sometimes seems unreasonable, and it sometimes even seems evil, but that the truth has the advantage that it is the truth, and and this is what we have to cling to, and this is what, if we hold on to truth, we don't fall into confusion. Anyway, this is what I see what they're getting at. What Hadding?
Truth is the basis for a consensus among thinking people.
Oh, isn't that good? Yes. That's so good. And this is what we're, you know, we have too many people who aren't thinking people, don't we?
Oh, yeah.
And we have to encourage people to stop and think and, you know, not fall prey to this sensationalist stuff that goes on all the time. And we certainly get plenty of that on the internet, as though if we didn't get plenty of it before in regular media, you know, it's there on the internet too. So we're going to continue now. And Hattie is going to read, and I'm going to do the parts of the protocol, from the protocol. So, okay, Hattie, take it over.
Okay, it talks about using the ideas around democracy against public opinion, I guess, to sow division. And this paragraph where we're about to start up begins as follows. This first step does not give the control of public opinion, but leads up to it. It is worthy of note that it is this sowing of the poison of liberalism, as the protocols name it, which comes in order in those documents.
First in order.
Comes first in order in those documents. The poison of liberalism. Then, following upon that, the protocols say,
to obtain control over public opinion is the first necessary... No, I'm messing that up. To obtain control over public opinion, it is first necessary to confuse it.
Ooh. Truth is one and cannot be confused. But this false appealing liberalism, which has been sown broadcast and which is ripening faster under Jewish nurture in America than ever it did in Europe, is easily confused because it is not truth. It is error, and error has a thousand forms. Take a nation, a party, a city, an association in which the poison of liberalism has been sown, and you can split that up into as many factions as there are individuals, simply by throwing among them certain modifications of the original idea. This is a piece of strategy well known to the forces that invisibly control mass thought. Theodor Herzl, the arch-Jew, a man whose vision was wider than any statesman's and whose program paralleled the protocols, knew this many years ago when he said that the Zionist, cryptic for Jewish, state would come before the socialist state would come. He knew with what endless divisions the liberalism, which he and his predecessors had planted, would be shackled and crippled.
Okay, so Herzl said that the Zionist state, or the Jewish state, he meant, would come before the socialist state. So, could come, before the socialist state even could come. But that is not the way it actually worked. Oh, is it the way it worked out? Yeah.
Really?
I mean, yeah, socialist. I'm thinking communist. I'm thinking of, you know, didn't come before the socialist state. But he wouldn't have said this. He didn't live that long ago. So if he said this, I mean, didn't the socialist state, you think he was talking about Soviet Russia, Soviet Union, that kind of a state, a Soviet socialist state, not what we think of as more moderate type socialist states.
Well, I mean, that would seem to be the reference here. I mean,
yeah. In any event, he's saying
the Jews come first.
He has to say the Jews are going to come first, Jewish control, and then we'll have socialism, socialist states. That seems to be what he's kind of saying, whether he's right or not.
The only way I can reconcile that as a true prediction is to say that the World Zionist Organization counts as a state without territory, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, that's a possibility,
but as
too.
As far as what people would generally assume that this means, it didn't really pan out that way.
Okay, well, let's go on then.
Okay.
process.
Yeah, the process of which all Gentiles have been the victims, but never the Jews, is just this. First, to create an ideal of broad-mindedness. That is the phrase which appears in every Jewish remonstrance against public mention of the Jew and his alleged world program. We thought you were too broad-minded a man to express such thoughts. We thought Mr. So-and-so was too broad-minded a man to suspect the Jews of this. We thought the daily or weekly or monthly such-and-such a paper was too broad-minded editorially to consider such material. It is a sort of key word indicative of the state of mind in which it is desired that the Gentiles be kept. It is a state of flabby tolerance, a state of mind which mouths meaningless phrases about liberty, phrases which act as an opiate on the mind and conscience, and which allow all sorts of things to be done under cover. The phrase, the slogan, is a very dependable Jewish weapon.
Yeah, I like that, too. He's calling it, well, somebody's calling it, well, the international Jew writers are calling it a Jewish weapon.
Yeah.
This whole slogan about broad-mindedness, you know, I remember that kind of, I remember that word, of course. I don't think that's used much anymore, but it used to be. And that was the modern thing. You were to be more broad-minded. And of course, that opposes what narrow-minded, which had a very bad connotation, very bad to be narrow-minded. And they say some pretty interesting things about this as we go along.
Yeah.
About narrow-mindedness. Yeah. That is good.
quotes Protocol 5 there. In all times, people have accepted words for acts.
Yeah.
The reality behind the phrase of the protocols, frankly, admit... Okay, the reality behind the phrase, broad-mindedness, the protocols, frankly, admit to be non-existent.
Right.
Nothing has served to create broad-mindedness, a state of mind whose breadth indicates its lack of depth, so much as the ideas of liberalism, which the Jews are constantly teaching to Gentiles, and on which they never themselves act. We need a new sort of allegiance to the reality of life, to the facts as they are, which will enable us to stand up under all cajoling to broad-mindedness, and assert a new intolerance for everything but the truth.
Well, isn't that good? And you know, he says, they were saying back in 1920 they needed that. We need that today still. You know, yeah. we need to pull ourselves up, and we need to get some allegiance to only the truth and to the facts as they are. And this gives us some strength, and we've got most of our people, even people who are in our movement, who are not really capable of doing that because yeah. They've got an interest here, they got an interest there, they got, you know, things that they don't want to go against, they don't want to be intolerant of, so on and so forth.
Yeah, this kind of rhetorical shysterism is very dominant in American political life, and it even colors a large part of the white nationalist milieu. People making arguments that they think will have an effect on people rather than sticking to the facts and the truth.
Exactly. They think, well, if we say this, it will have the right effect. The
yeah.
effect we want to get across. So it does, you know, and we, you know, even if it's not following the truth, it will in the end lead us there. Well, it doesn't necessarily, do you think? If you're going to leave, you know, I think that's where you go off the straight and narrow road. I know I sound more and more like a real straight and narrow person, but I really think I am becoming, coming to believe that. more and more. That's why, because we just see what the heck is going on with every kind of tolerant attitude that we've ever come up with. Look at the consequences of it. Pretty terrible.
My view is that it is possible for the Jews, since they control a lot of mass media, practically all of it, it's possible for them to get away with some manipulative propaganda that isn't exactly true. And it doesn't really catch up with them because they have this constant, repetitive, loud, booming voice, the loudspeaker constantly saying this, so that people that don't think very much, which is most people, will never catch on. We don't have that. We have to try to appeal to the people who do think. And if you try to use the same kind of manipulative rhetoric as the Jews, it doesn't work for us because we don't have the loudspeakers everywhere to repeat it constantly. We have to try to appeal to that little glimmer of reason in the few people that have it and try to get them to realize that what the loudspeakers are saying all the time is not right.
Well, that's well put. Very well put. Everybody should be able to follow that. Okay, good.
All right. The terms narrow and broad, as they are used today, represent lies. The liberal man ought to believe more. He ought to be deep and wide in his beliefs in order to merit that name. But as a usual thing, he believes nothing. He is not liberal at all, in the 19th century sense. When you seek belief, belief with a foundation, belief with vitality, you must seek it among men who are sneered at under this false Jewish-promoted notion of liberality as narrow men. Jewish propaganda, in common with the protocols, is against men who have dug down to the rock. They want broad-minded men who can easily be shifted about the surface and thus serve the invisible scheme in any manner desired. This type of men, on their part, never imagine but that their broad-mindedness is a mark of the superior of their superiority and independence.
Yeah, now that sounds like the Freemasons padding. You know, they are broad-minded. They're trying to tell people that, you know, let this is the modern day and age, and you know, and they feel very superior.
Well, there's certainly truth in that, insofar as they consider that all of the specific religions are just perversions of the one true religion that's the basis of all of them.
Yeah.
That's the doctrine. That's really the central doctrine of Freemasonry.
Yeah, which is really a kind of a fraud. They're not really so religious. Well, you know, I don't know how much these people who started it really. Well, didn't the Jews start it? I mean, how could they?
I don't think so. I'm not an expert. I looked at a lot of Freemasonic books years ago because I used to listen to Patriot and Militia. Patriotard Media, mm-hmm. And some of them like to talk about Freemasons all the time because they're afraid to talk about Jews.
Right.
And so I got things like Albert Pike's Morals and Dogma and read through them. What was the question again?
maybe some of these Freemasons really did believe that they were looking for the one true religion. But then I said, well, I'm not so sure whether anybody believed that. And then I said, well, weren't they Jews?
No, so, I don't think the Jews started Freemasonry. As near as I could determine, there probably is some better scholarship on the subject. But I read, from reading Nesta Webster, Secret Societies and Subversive Movements, it seemed to me, from the information that she presented, that Freemasonry had been around before And then sometime in the 1700s, it got taken over by Jews, or maybe just a little earlier than that.
Well, how early could it have started, 1700s? That's what we hear about. 1600s, was there some of it? Wouldn't have been earlier than that.
There's some earlier quasi-Masonic orders, like the Rosicrucians.
When did they start?
I'm not sure exactly, but Sir Francis Bacon was a Rosicrucian.
Well, I'm thinking about the, Jacob Boehme. What are those people? I was reading his books back when I was young, getting all carried away with that. Oh, what was that? Gnosticism and so on. Is that the kind of the beginning of what Freemasonry could have come out of?
I mean, the legend is that Freemasonry was some kind of persistent organization that was kind of a remnant of the Knights Templar. I'm not sure if that's true. I think that's very dubious. I think it was a kind of paganism, and they had the first three degrees, and the Jews introduced the degrees above the third, which are based, to the extent that I can determine, the degrees above the third are based on the Kabbalah.
Kabbalah. It's crazy. I can understand having 3 degrees. But then when you go from 3 to 33, which they seem to have had to do, and nobody ever hears anything about what happens in between 3 and 33, it's kind of like nothing happens. They just like that number 33, which is double the 3. Ah, well. Okay, well, let's go on. We can't answer all those questions.
Yeah, it's a little bit of mystery there. And then you get people asserting that the 33rd isn't really the highest degree. There are secret degrees above that.
Oh, sure, yeah.
There's no end to the craziness. Now see what follows. Men are born believers. For a time, they may believe in broad-mindedness, and under the terrific social pressure that has been set up in its favor, they will openly espouse it. But it is too shallow to satisfy any growing roots of life. They must believe deeply something.
Well, I like that. I like that whole thing. I think that's important, an important statement. Men are born believers. I know I am. I mean, I know I've always wanted to believe something. I have to find something to believe, you know. I mean, I've never not believed in anything. You know, we have to. And belief, sometimes we make fun of, you know, sometimes we, not make fun, but, you know, we look down at belief and say, well, I don't want to believe, I want to know. And, you know, I don't believe things I find out and research and find facts and so on. You know, there's truth to all of that. But in the end, belief is the most powerful thing in my estimation in the entire universe. I mean, belief, another thing you can call it is, belief is, I've lost my thought about that, but it is, you know, it's foundational in us, and it's very, very, very powerful. When you believe something, you really believe it. You just make it true. It's just true for you, you know, and things, even your experiences will bear that out when they might not bear it out with somebody else. I mean, it alters, I guess, your view, your vision and your view, but it also gives you a power to carry out things that you really believe in.
Well, people hate being uncertain, and they hate being ambivalent. They True. Want to feel certain. They want True. To be, they want to be in total inner harmony and feel that they know exactly the right thing. Also, this was something that I saw in a newspaper years ago. There is a center in the brain that seems to be responsible for religious instinct. It was referred in this newspaper article. It was called the God module in the brain. Happens to be a center in the brain that, if it gets stimulated too much, causes epileptic seizures.
Oh, yeah, that's why some of those religious mystics...
Yeah, well, like Dostoevsky.
Yeah, him too. Yeah.
Interesting thing: Jews have less than Jews have less epilepsy on average than white people.
Oh, they don't have that much activity in their religious center.
Yeah, they're apparently less religious, less prone toward altruism.
There you go. Maybe we have too much religion. Okay. Well, we wouldn't have too much if we didn't have the Jews around, probably. You know, taking
our
advantage
religious
of that
instincts
in us.
And our altruistic tendencies get warped in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
Instead of being tempered and controlled. They must believe deeply something. For proof of this, notice the undeniable strength of the negative beliefs which are held by men who fancy that they believe nothing. Therefore, some who are highly endowed with the independence of spirit root down into those prohibited matters which at some point touch Jewish concerns. These are the narrow men.
Yeah, just real quickly, yeah, that's what I was referring to, and I like that, you know, because I like when these things that are just generally put out as being negative, like being narrow, you know, is counteracted in a way like this to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, because narrow is good, and it is that you go down in deeply, and because you're looking at something specifically, you're not staying in the broad range, you know, and in that, when you do that, like they say, when you go deep enough, you're always going to touch Jewish concerns.
Oh. Yeah, trying to nail people down to specifics is a sure way to spoil somebody's fun. But others find it more convenient to cultivate those departments which promise a highway, whereupon there shall be no clashes of vital opinion, no chance of their charge of intolerance. In short, they transfer all their contemplative powers to the active life, even as it is written in the protocols.
To divert Gentile thought and observation, interest must be deflected to industry and commerce.
It is amazing to look around and see the number of men who have been actually browbeaten into committing their whole lives to these secondary or even tertiary things, while they look with great timidity and aversion at the vital things which really rule the world, and upon which the issue of which the world really depends. And upon the issue of which the world really depends. But it is just this deflection to the materialistic base that offers the protocolists, and similarly Jewish propagandists, their best hold. Broad-mindedness today consists in leaving vital matters severely alone. It descends quickly to material-mindedness. Within this lower sphere, all the discord which distresses the world today is to be found. First, there is the ruin of the upper circles of industry and commerce.
To make it possible for liberty definitely to disintegrate and ruin Gentile society, industry must be placed on a speculative basis.
That means stock markets.
There you go.
No one needs to be told what this means. It means, as everything about us shouts, the prostitution of service to profits and the eventual disappearance of the profits. It means that the high art of management degenerates into exploitation. It means reckless confusion among the managers and dangerous unrest among the workmen.
Yeah, well, you know, haven't we passed through this already? The prostitution of service to profits. You know, I'm thinking, it made me think of back when there were full service gas stations. This is a small thing, but, you know, that was when gas was real cheap, too. And you went to get your gas, and this guy runs out from the little, you know, enclosure there, and starts putting gas in your car, and then starts washing all your windows, and asks you if you want to have your oil checked, and none of it cost anymore. Then they came up with you had your choice between self-service and full service, but at the self-service, the gas was a few cents cheaper,
yeah.
And so naturally, we all, because we wanted to save those few cents, it might have been 5 cents to begin with or something and of course gas wasn't as much then, at all. So it made a bigger difference. And, we all thought, well, we don't need to have, you know, we can do that ourselves. It was kind of a thing, you know, And nobody would want to be seen there in the full service because some lazy people would be sitting there, can't even pump their own gas. Well, then it got worse and worse until now, you know, we're all working away at these service stations and paying $3 a gallon or four for gas. You know, just a perfect example of that. Mm-hmm. Well, the profits didn't disappear, but maybe the people who make the oil, the gas, are not making as much profit as we like to think.
I'm not sure about that.
But the gas stations don't, particularly. They need to have those little convenience stores in order to make money. The people buying overpriced snack food. Right. Oh, well. All right.
But it means something worse. It means the split up of Gentile society. Not a division between capital and labor, but the division between the Gentiles at both ends of the working scheme. Gentile managers and manufacturers are not the capitalists of the United States. Most of them have to go to the capitalists for the funds with which they work. And the capitalists are Jewish, international Jews. He's talking about finance capitalists, loan capitalists. Says they're Jews, those are the real capitalists. Mm-hmm. The ones that Marx doesn't talk about very much. But with Jewish capital at one end of the Gentile working scheme, putting the screws on the manufacturers, and with Jewish agitators and disruptionists and subversives at the other end of the Gentile working scheme, putting the screws on the workmen, we have a condition at which the world managers of the protocol program must be immensely satisfied.
Hmm.
There's a quote for you.
Oh, yeah. Protocol 9. We might fear the combined strength of the Gentiles of vision with the blind strength of the masses, but we have taken all measures against such a possible contingency by raising a wall of mutual antagonism between these two forces. Thus, the blind force of the masses remains our support. We and we alone shall serve as their leaders. Naturally, we will direct their energy to achieve our end.
Right. Well, it does sort of look that way. The indication that they are highly satisfied is that they are not only not doing anything to relieve the situation, but are apparently willing to have it made worse. And if it be at all possible for them to do so, they would like to see this coming winter and the privations which are scheduled for it, unless Gentile flabbiness before the Jewish power, high and low, receives a new backbone, bring the United States to the verge of, if not across, the very line of Bolshevism. They know the whole method of artificial scarcity and high prices. It was practiced in the French Revolution and in Russia. All the signs of it are in this country, too.
Well, I found this very strong talk. And these guys, these writers, and I'm sure they discussed all this with Henry Ford regularly, so I don't want to act, you know, make it sound like Henry Ford took no part in this, because these were certainly his thoughts. But they must have been angry. You know, they must have been getting mad when they were writing this. And, you know, they don't leave any doubt about it, and they're absolutely blaming Jewish power. And they said that the coming privations of this winter, well, this would be the winter of 1920-1921. Was there something in particular happening, and were there maybe, was this one of the economic downturns before the roaring 20s got going, or what?
There was a farm crisis around that time.
Yeah, or something. Something must
there
have
was.
Been something.
And
okay.
But, you know, shortly after this, Congress changed the immigration laws and also deported some Jewish radicals.
Oh, really?
Yes, they did.
Yeah, so the whole country must have been aware and fed up and angry, and the Jews were being seen for what they were doing. But somehow they, you know, if you don't really get rid of them, They always have the ability to come back, even if they have to lay low for a short time. They never laid low much in the United States, but okay.
Well, it's like a plant that has runners underground. You know, you cut off one stem that's growing out of the ground. It doesn't mean you got rid of the whole
plant.
That's
right. Yeah, you got to get rid of all of it. When that's really hard to even talk about. Okay.
Industrial problems for their mental food and light amusement are their leisure hours.
For their leisure hours, right?
For their leisure hours. These are the protocol's method with regard to the Gentile mind, and under cover of these, the work is to be done. The work which is best expressed by the motto, divide and rule.
Okay. Protocol 13. To divert over-restless people from discussing political questions, we shall now bring forward new problems, apparently connected with them, problems of industry. I keep going back to industry.
Yeah. Well, it's that whole Marxist thing. Has not everyone been struck by the divorcement which exists in this country between the mass thought, which is almost exclusively devoted to industrial questions, and the party thought, which is endeavoring to keep the field of pure politics? And is it not a fact that our friends, the Jews, are strongly entrenched in both fields, in politics to keep it reactionary, and in industrial circles to keep it radical, and so widen the split? And what is this split but a split of the Gentiles? For society is Gentile, and the disruptive influences are Jewish. Read this.
Yeah, before I do, I like that they've referred to this before, that of course society has changed, but it's still Gentile, even if it's not white. But society is Gentile, and the disruptive influences are Jewish. You know, if we could remember that, because today too many people look at all the non-whites, and sometimes I do too, and they say, well, look at these disruptive influences. These are the problem. You know, these blacks, these Mexicans, these Chinese, this and that. What else is there? But basically, if we would, we should remember that it's the Jews against the Gentiles. Although I don't want to join up with these other Gentiles, but we don't think of ourselves as Gentile anyway. Well, we keep having to use this word in here, Gentile. But anyway, yeah. They are saying here, you know, that it's the Jews. It's the Jews. That's what they're saying. It's the Jews. It's the Jews, stupid. Okay, I have to read the protocol now. Protocol,
yes, it says read this.
Yes, Protocol 3. We have included in the Constitution rights for the people that are fictitious and not actual rights. Oh, I didn't read that right. We have included in the Constitution rights for the people that are fictitious and not actual rights. All those so-called, what does he mean, our Constitution?
It would have to mean the French Constitution. Well, or depending on where you think the thing originated, probably if this comes from Joly, then it would be the French Constitution.
Yeah, it might be that. Okay. All those so-called rights of the people can only exist in the abstract and can never be realized in practice. The proletarian gains no more from the Constitution than the miserable crumbs thrown from our table in return for his votes to elect our agents and pass our measures. Republican rights are a bitter irony to the poor man, for the pressure of daily labor prevents him from using them, and at the same time deprives him of the guarantee of a permanent and certain livelihood by making him dependent upon strikes organized either by his employers or his comrades. That's kind of a hard one to follow. Hmm. It's long sentences.
Well, what he's saying there is that freedom, this kind of negative liberty that we have guaranteed in the Constitution, even in the United States Constitution, isn't really worth much if you don't have any material wealth. What's your freedom of speech worth to you if you're scared to death of losing your job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have so many people in this country that are scared to lose their job and don't say anything because of it.
True. You know, now it's gotten, I have to be aware of losing my website. You know, I've gotten things ironed out there. It's working well. I am going to get on my own server and so on. But, you know, doing that and deciding on the server company and the kind of terms they have, you know, terms of service and so on, and reading that, and it makes you aware and knowing what they've done to some websites recently, taking them down, you know, forcing them off, not hosting them any longer. You know, I had to think, well, you know, am I going to feel censored because, you know, I don't want to break any, don't want them to be able to come at me. And then again, as we know, if they want to come at you, they'll come at you with anything. Because in one instance here that I know of this, of Bill Fink's site, you know, they didn't, he asked for them to point out where he had broken their, you know, terms of service, what particular thing or what things, and they would not say. They just say, you did, period, you know. You didn't follow, you didn't follow this. We have complaints, and so we found that there's validity for it, and that's it, goodbye. So, you know, they don't have to do any of that. So you might as well say what you want, which is what I intend to do.
Yeah. If you really want freedom of speech, you have to be in a position where you have nothing to lose, or whatever you have can't be taken away from you. Like, for example, a self-sufficient farmer. Thomas Jefferson wanted the United States to continue to be populated primarily with small farmers because it would be good for freedom, for individual freedom. But we don't have that today.
No. We think we have. You know, people still think we're the freest we've ever been. We're the freest nation in the world, freer than ever in history. But, well, I guess, though, people have never really been free. Maybe until thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago.
Well, that's always relative.
Yeah.
This remark about strikes is not at all puzzling to anyone who has studied the different types of strikes in this country. The number fomented from above the working class is astoundingly large. Read this also.
We will force up wages, which, however, will be of no benefit to the workers, for we will, at the same time, cause a rise in the prices of necessities, pretending that this is due to the decline of agriculture and of cattle raising. We will also artfully and deeply undermine the sources of production by instilling in the workmen ideas of anarchy. From Protocol 6.
And this.
We will represent ourselves as the saviors of the working class who have come to liberate them from this oppression by suggesting that they join our army of socialists, anarchists, communists, to whom we always extend our help under the guise of the fraternal principles of universal human solidarity. Protocol 3.
Broad-mindedness again. In this connection, it is always well to remember the words of Sir Eustace Percy, heretofore quoted, words which are sponsored by Jews themselves, not because the Jew cares for the positive side of radical philosophy, not because he desires to be a partaker in Gentile nationalism or Gentile democracy, but because no existing Gentile system of government is ever anything but distasteful to him. Or, as the author of The Conquering Jew says, he is a democrat. He is democratic in his sentiments, but not in his nature. When he proclaims the common brotherhood of man, he is asking that the social gate now closed against him in so many quarters shall be opened to him, not because he wants equality, but because he desires to be master in the social world. He is showing himself in so many other spheres. Many an honorable Jew will, I doubt not, dispute the accuracy of this distinction. But if he does, it will be because he has lived so long in the atmosphere of the West that he is unconscious of what is bred in the bone of his Eastern race.
Yeah, so they say, that he's saying there in this Conquering Jew, that he proclaims his common brotherhood because he wants all the social areas to be open to him, not because he wants just the equality, the ability to do it, because he wants to be master in the social world as well as in the financial world and other worlds. And that's what he gained, particularly in Britain. They've gained it everywhere, but they certainly gained it big time in Britain, because they were able to become lords and everything else. And now they are, and they sound like they have British names, a lot of them, and you can't tell them from anyone else, and they're 100% Jewish.
Oh, I think you can tell them, but,
if you know a thing.
There's this series about Enoch Powell and his Rivers of Blood speech that's on YouTube. And one of Enoch Powell's worst enemies was this guy named Lord Lester QC. QC stands for Queen's Counsel. He's a Jew.
Yeah.
They don't tell you that, of course, in this BBC show. But you go to Wikipedia, you can find out Lord Lester QC is a Jew.
So I think there's something, is it here or was it somewhere else I was reading, where they're sitting in the House of Lords and they're talking about, as a Jew this and as a Jew that, where they're all these Jews in the House of Lords.
Mm-hmm.
We better move on.
Money.
Yeah, that's right. They bought it all. They get, I mean, it's a regular thing. If you give enough money to the crown, to the queen or to the whatever, the royal house, or even now to these political parties or somewhere, that's it. You buy it. And Britain has been for sale like that, really shamefully, forever. I mean, for going way back anyway. They're more for sale. I mean, I'm not saying everybody, they're not all, it's to some degree for sale, but gee, the British have.
That's what Brooks Adams says, is that the United Kingdom is in the late stages of plutocratic decay. And they've been that way for a few hundred years now.
It must be their commercialism. You know, they're very commercial thinkers. And it just seemed natural or made sense to make money from, and to sell whatever they had. That's what they were selling their rights. They were selling everything.
Well, the thing is, you always have some people that are inclined that way, but when you have centralization and commerce is facilitated, that type tends to become more dominant, and they force out the people, what they call spiritual men, what Brooks Adams calls spiritual men. They force them out and take away their land, and a lot of the emigration from Britain was by people that just didn't fit in England anymore.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. We better go on.
All right. It is not difficult, therefore, to see the genealogy of the Jewish ideas of liberalism from their origin to their latest effects upon Gentile life. The confusion aimed for is here. There is not a reader of these lines who has not felt in his own life the burden of it. Bewilderment characterizes the whole mental climate of the people today. They do not know what to believe. First one set of facts is given to them, then another. First one explanation of conditions is given to them, then another. The fact shortage is acute. There is a whole market full of explanations that explain nothing, but only deepen the confusion. The government itself seems to be hampered, and whenever it starts on a line of investigation, finds itself mysteriously tangled up so that procedure is difficult. This governmental aspect is also set forth in the protocols. Add to this the onslaught on the human tendency toward religion, which is usually the last barrier to fall before violence and robbery and unashamed stalk forth. Well, let me do that again. Add to this the onslaught on the human tendency toward religion, which is usually the last barrier to fall before violence and robbery, unashamed, stalk forth. In order to bring the condition about at which this world program aims, the fourth protocol says,
it is for this reason that we must undermine faith, eradicate from the minds of the Gentiles the very principles of God and soul, and replace these conceptions by mathematical calculations and material desires. When we deprived the masses of their belief in God, ruling authority was thrown into the gutter, where it became public property, and we seized it. That's from Protocol 5. Then from Protocol 17, we have taken good care long ago to discredit the Gentile clergy. And from Protocol 14, when we become rulers, we shall regard as undesirable the existence of any religion except our own, proclaiming one God with whom our fate is tied as the chosen people, and by whom our fate has been made one with the fate of the world. For this reason, we must destroy all other religions. If thereby should emerge contemporary atheists, then, as a transition step, this will not interfere with our aims. So, you know, they're saying when they take over, of course, you don't believe in the protocols, but when they take over altogether, you won't even be able to be an atheist. You will have to believe in their religion, everybody. Okay.
This will probably offer matter for reflection by the broad-minded. It is curious to note how this religious program has worked out in Russia, where Trotsky, as loudly heralded in the American Jewish press, is said to have no religion, and where Jewish commissars tell dying Russians who ask for priests, "We have abolished the Almighty." Miss Catherine Dokuchev is reported, under a Philadelphia date, to have told the Near East Relief that Russian Christian churches have been subjected to the vilest indignities by the Bolsheviki, details of which she gives, but the synagogues remain untouched, meeting with no damage, she says. All these lines of attack, whose object is the destruction of the natural rallying points of Gentile thought and the substitution of other rallying points of an unwholesome and destructive nature, are assisted, as we saw in the last article, by the propaganda for luxury. Luxury is recognizedly one of the most enervating influences. Its course runs from ease through softness to flabbiness to degeneracy, mental, physical, and moral. Its beginnings are attractive. Its end is lasciviousness in some form, testifying to the complete breakdown of all the strong fiber of life. It may make a theme for a more complete study someday, this lure to lasciviousness through luxury, and the identity of the forces that set the lure. But now, to conclude this general view of the method, rather this part of the method, the confusion itself, which all these influences converge to produce, is expected to produce another more deeply helpless state. And that state is exhaustion. It needs no imagination to see what this means. Exhaustion is today one of the conditions that menace the people. The recent political conventions and their effect upon the public fully illustrate it. Nobody seemed to care. Parties might make their declarations and candidates their promises. Nobody cared. The war and its strain began the exhaustion. The peace and its confusion have about completed it. The people believe little and expect less. Confidence is gone. Initiative is nearly gone. The failure of movements falsely heralded as people's movements has gone far to make the people think that no people's movement is possible. So say the protocols.
to wear everyone out by dissensions, animosities, feuds, famine, inoculation of diseases, want, until the Gentiles see no other way of escape except an appeal to our money and power. We will so wear out and exhaust, that's Protocol 10. We will so wear out and exhaust the Gentiles by all this that they will be compelled to offer us an international authority by which by its position will enable us to absorb without disturbance all the governmental forces of the world and thus form a super government. So we must direct the education of Gentile society that its hands will drop in the weakness of discouragement in the face of any undertaking where initiative is needed. Protocol 5.
The Jews have never been worn out or exhausted. They have never been nonplussed. This is the true psychic characteristic of those who have a clue to the maze. It is the unknown that exhausts the mind. The constant wandering around among tendencies and influences whose source is not known and whose purpose is not understood. Walking in the dark is wearing work. The Gentiles have been doing it for centuries. The others, having a pretty accurate idea of what it was all about, have not succumbed. Even persecution is endurable if it is understandable, and the Jews of the world have always known just where it fitted in the scheme of things. Gentiles have suffered more from Jewish persecution than have the Jews. For after the persecutions were over, the Gentiles was as much in the dark as ever, whereas Judaism simply took up again its century-long march toward a goal in which it implicitly believes, and which some say who have deep knowledge of Jewish roots in the world, and who too may be touched with exhaustion, they will achieve. However this may be, the revolution which would be necessary to unfasten the international Jewish system from its grip on the world would probably have to be just as radical as any attempts the Jews have made to attain that grip. There are those who express serious doubts that the Gentiles are competent to do it at all. Maybe not. Let them at least know who their conquerors are.
You know, that's a strong ending to that very good chapter and very important one. And we've got 60 seconds, Hadding, so we just got through with this. But, you know, they're putting forth a challenge here, and obviously they're feeling a little pessimistic right at this moment. And they're saying that what all that it took the Jews to do to build this up, it will take, you know, the same kind of radical, strong thinking, devoted kind of thinking to undo it. And it's seriously, those who understand this seriously doubt that the Gentiles are up to it. And, you know,
about a radical movement, it sounds like he's presaging national socialism.
Well, really, it was Hitler who had the only idea and his associates on how to accomplish this. And look what the rest of the Gentile world did to stop it.
Yes.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being with us tonight. And we will return next week with chapter 14, beginning a brand new chapter. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.